Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we're talking food with James Oslin. He's the editor-in-chief of Sevier, America's most critically acclaimed food magazine, and he also makes appearances on Bravo Television. Under his leadership, Sevier has won over 35 awards in recent years, including several James Beard Awards. His 2006 book, Cradle of Flavor, was a memoir with recipes about his time living in Southeast Asia. He's also the editor of Sevier's cookbooks, including Sevier, the New Comfort Food. He appeared on Studio Tulsa when that book was first published, which included a recipe for an Oklahoma El Reno onion burger, which was an homage to his time he spent living in nearby Yukon, Oklahoma. You probably best know Oslin for his appearances as a judge on Bravo Television's Top Chef Masters. Their fourth season got underway last month. He's visiting Tulsa while researching an article on Heartland Food, and he made an appearance for Book Smart Tulsa yesterday. I spoke with him when he dropped by the studio. James Oslin is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. James Oslin, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's great to be here again.
Let's talk a little bit about the basis of, I think your first writing was about Southeast Asian cuisine. It's one of the things that you write a lot about. Mm-hmm. What interests you in Southeast Asian cuisine? And we're talking about, I guess, Indonesia, Malaysia, perhaps south of Thailand and Vietnamese cuisine, probably.
Right? Yeah, but also including Thailand and Vietnam, too. But, you know, it was actually complete serendipity, total happenstance how I ended up in Southeast Asia. It was when I was 19 years old. I'm mostly from California, and I went to college in California, film school. And like most Americans, pretty much had a kind of negative consciousness about Indonesia and really Southeast Asia, maybe with the exception of, okay, Vietnam, the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And a fellow student was, it turns out, from Indonesia. And she and I knew each other a little bit. And pretty much very casually, one afternoon when we were walking off campus together, Tanya was her name, she said, oh, do you want to come to Indonesia this summer? We were a few months away from the summer break at that point. And I basically, you know, I was not a world traveler at that point. I'd been to Mexico once, and it was like, Yeah, I want to go. I think I probably kind of alarmed her with the ferocity of my answer. And in short order, like in 6 weeks, I was in Jakarta, and it was supposed to have been just a couple of a week trip, but it ended up being almost for the better part of a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, were you a foodie at that point?
You know, indirectly, I was. I guess, though, I might have been a typical American about my geographic consciousness and not really understanding Southeast Asia. I wasn't a typical American in the sense that I did really actually think a lot about food. I sort of always have. My dad was a traveling salesman. He sold office products. And so he would travel the country. And my dad was sort of one of the original foodies, and he would come back from wherever he'd been traveling. He was a great cook, and he would duplicate all the great restaurant classics that he'd eaten on the way.
No, so when you say a foodie, when we think of traveling salesman, we think of diners, but it sounds like it's probably a little more upscale than that.
It was a little more upscale than that, but then also not.
Yeah.
And so I grew up eating, like, crazy dishes, like, you know, my dad's rendition of duck à l'orange and sauerbraten. And this is back in the 60s.
When that was unheard of, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much.
Unless you were ethnic.
At least in the home, at least in, you know, the middle class home kitchen, suburban home kitchen, which is, you know, what I grew up in. And so I don't know. I've just always had this kind of like super gutsy, innate interest in food. And it became like a way for my dad and I to sort of experience the world together. I learned to cook at his side. Eventually, I started cooking my own, which was pretty early, like 9 or 10 years old. And eventually, I kind of took over.
So when you went to Indonesia and these whole melange of spices that, you know, we don't taste over here, or at least in sort of white bread America.
Well, that's the thing. That is just completely the thing. Like, I had a somewhat sophisticated palate, but it was all sort of very much within the, you know, just within the range of American classics, your meatloaf, your all of those things that
just meat and immediately potatoes.
Completely meat and potatoes, all those things that your mind immediately thinks of, plus Western Europe a little bit, the sauerbraten, for instance, the duck à l'orange. And Caesar salad, actually, but I guess that's not Western European, but that was like my favorite thing to make, basically from the time I was about 10 years old on. But I had virtually no experience with, you know, what I was going to encounter in Indonesia, and I was completely blown away. First couple of weeks I was there, I gotta say, I was kind of daunted. It was sort of like, what have I gotten myself into? This place is so hot. So dirty, so loud, so foreign, kind of flipped out. And food for me, after I got out of that sort of initial state of being hyper flipped out, food for me became this way of understanding this place. And I was completely blown away by it, as I said. The flavors that I was encountering, the colors that I was encountering, the textures, the friendliness of the cooks, the people who made these foods and their willingness to share these foods with me, it helped me understand and really grow very quickly to love this place.
I would think from what little I know of that region of the world, I think of it as being a sort of a street food culture very much.
It is, but the best food is in people's homes. But it's pretty street food crazy.
So is that how you begin learning about it, from the street food itself or from in people's homes?
Both. You know, it's funny you mentioned that. One of my favorite images from those first couple of months of being there was the complete unfamiliarity of the constant stream of street food vendors in Indonesia, and in Jakarta in particular, these guys and sometimes ladies come by on carts basically 24 hours a day. These little three-wheeled carts that they push, and you've got like a full banquet. You basically don't have to cook, but there's just this, because there's this steady stream of food constantly outside your door. So, you know, you're right. In particular, in Indonesia and in Jakarta are the satay vendors. These guys, those, for some reason, these are usually men. I don't know what the sexist deal is there. But it's usually men, and they carry these little grills with them, these kind of little handmade grills that are like little mini hibachis, basically. And they have this already marinated meat that they fire up the grill, you know, per order, and, you know, slap the thing on there. 5 minutes later, you have the most delicious, spice-laden satay you've ever had in your life. I wish we had such a thing in America.
You know, we have pale imitations of it. I always call that meat on stick.
I think that's what satay translates.
But it is good. And of course, that was the subject of your first book, Cradle of Flavor.
Yes.
Which was sort of a memoir of sort of telling some of these sorts of stories,
yeah,
as well as.
Absolutely. And I mean, really kind of at its heart, what that book was about for me was about, you know, maybe this is kind of a subtle interpretation, my interpretation, but it's about how you almost can kind of transform what you were through the exquisite experience of finding out new food. How the great, voluptuous, sensual thing of understanding a new cuisine can actually kind of change you. Because I think I was definitely a different person before that trip.
In what ways?
I was more limited. I was, I had a smaller sense of the world, and in a way, that small sense of the world that I had absolutely, you know, correlated with how I saw the world of food and what my palate, you know, was ready to accept or not. And having that all sort of like upended, really turned upside down by that trip. In particular, the foods that I ate on that trip, you know, it totally, absolutely, completely, permanently changed me.
Now, a lot of people will say travel does that, but you specifically say food helps sort of broaden that.
You know, I'll tell you, food for me is one of the most clear and amazing conduits into understanding a place. You know, I think maybe in another lifetime I might have been an anthropologist, but I guess now I'm just an avid eater. But, you know, what I have found, you know, from that first, you know, big bunch of traveling that I did, you know, in my late teens in Southeast Asia, all the way to now, even just over the last few days, I've been in central and northeastern Kansas. To understand a place, you have to understand how it eats, what it eats, how the people who live in that place shop for food, how they grow food, if they do grow food, or how they bring food into that place they live, and then what they do with it in their kitchens, or maybe they just eat fast food, and that's incredibly telling too. But I you know, you would think maybe after so many years of traveling the world, now basically pushing, well, 35 years of traveling the world eating, that maybe I'd grow kind of tired of it. No, not at all. In fact, that I always can't wait to just hit the road again and find out something new.
The one thing about a different cuisine is, you know, our palates are different. How do you get through, you know, I mean, when you go certain places, you're eating food that you're just not used to tasting.
But you know what, though? See, that's the thing. I don't think our palates are so different. That's a...
Well, they're acclimatized maybe to a particular...
They're acclimatized. They're habituated to, yeah, like a certain range of flavors. Like me and my mashed potatoes and my meatloaf and my dad's sauerbraten, and having that all just sort of like the rug pulled out. Our palates are, you know, they're not so very different all over the world. You know, like, it's basically kind of akin to our skin color. It might be they're slightly different gradations, but basically it's, we're not so very different. And the funny thing is, like, sometimes we focus wherever we are. If we're in Indonesia, or if we're in Tulsa, Oklahoma, we focus on how different we are from other people. In fact, in all of my travels around the world, it's always the opposite that sort of resonates, that comes through, which is, no, in fact, we're so, so very similar. Yeah, some tastes are maybe a little more bitter in certain parts of the world, or more fiery hot, or more garlicky, or just spicy in general. But once you've allowed to just sort of step back maybe from your initial reaction of, that's shocking, and I don't know if I want to have that in my mouth. I think I want to spit that out. It's like the world opens up. And I think that's an amazing thing that we have the capacity to do that.
Now, you've been traveling through the heartland, and all those things you described about the cuisines of the world, when we think of the Midwest and where we are here in Oklahoma, and you lived in Oklahoma for a few years, mm-hmm. You know this cuisine well.
Yeah.
We think of the absence of all those fiery, garlicky, but what are the tastes of this particular part of the world?
It's funny because I just on this little road trip that I've been on the last few days, and mostly in central Kansas, as I was saying, I've eaten a lot of actually fantastic food, really, really, really good food. There was in particular, it must have been like a 150,000 calorie breakfast, but it was chicken fried steak and a sausage gravy and biscuits.
And real sausage gravy, I hope?
Real sausage.
That's a lost art right there.
I'll tell you, it probably was not the most beautiful plate of food that I've ever been served, visually speaking, but the food was just so absolutely perfectly executed. The gravy, at first it seemed like maybe this has a little bit too much flour in it. Maybe it's too thick, almost verging on a kind of pudding. No, it was perfect. The chicken fried steak was one of the best I've ever had. And I mean, to answer your question, generally speaking, the flavor palette here, at least to my feeling of it, my understanding of it, of course, it tends to be, you know, fairly conservative, doesn't push the spicy quality too far, or even the salty quality. But it's this very spare, beautiful, immediate kind of cooking, when people are really cooking, like old home-style prairie cooking, which I think is just one of the great American gifts to the world of food.
So things like chicken fried steak, pot roast?
Pot roast, fried chicken, even, you know, really, really good green beans just plucked from the garden that have been stewed for a while and some fat back and or bacon or
onions.
You can't, or onions. You know, that food, that's very, very amazing, spare, basic food. And when it's good, oh my goodness, it's good.
Yeah. Now, do you have that sort of home sense? Because you lived in California, you lived here in Oklahoma for a little while, that sort of coming home to like a chicken fried steak. I think people who have not grown up with chicken fried steak, it's kind of that leap of like, you know, going to the foreign culture to eat a chicken fried steak.
Well, you know, it's very true because when I lived in Oklahoma, I moved here, I guess it was about fifth grade and from the West Coast, and I'd never heard of such a thing and encountered it for the first
time. Probably got it at the school cafeteria.
That's exactly where I got it, at the school cafeteria. And I was a little scared, I've got to admit, because it's like, wait, what is this? Is this steak? Or is it chicken? And then eventually I overcame my trepidation and I entered the vast and wonderful world of chicken fried steak.
Is that when you come to this part of the country, is that the sort of thing you're looking for, chicken fried steak, or is there something else?
I'm looking for a good, this sounds maybe so obvious, but I'm looking for good local cooking, not cooking that's aspiring to be like New York City or California cooking or, you know, French cooking. Or I'm looking, you know, and I'm not saying that, of course, that a place like Tulsa should have a fabulous French restaurant or Spanish restaurant. But because I live in New York City and because I come from California, when I come to a place like Oklahoma, my perspective, I want to understand the sort of basic roots of the food here, because I can eat Spanish and Mexican and French food where I live, just a block from where I live. And so that's what I am hungry to experience when I travel.
You know, I've always felt like people look at me crazy, but mm-hmm. I think, you know, when you think of Tulsa, I think of, you know, obviously steak, chicken fried steak. Mm-hmm. I also think of, this is kind of weird, we have conies that are different than most other places. Mm-hmm. It's that sort of meat sauce, the small mm-hmm. little coney. Mm-hmm. I say that's probably Oklahoma as much as anything. And the other thing would be the Lebanese steakhouse.
Oh, yes.
The Lebanese, Lebanese hors d'oeuvres from the immigrants who came here when the oil boom
hit.
And you don't see that anywhere else.
No, absolutely not. And
people look at me crazy when I say this is our food.
No, we've in fact actually just a couple of years back covered that place in Sevier. Uh-huh. And you know, you're absolutely right. That place, now that I think about it for a minute, that is so quintessentially Tulsan. I mean, it's quintessentially Tulsan and it's quintessentially American, and it speaks of like the great convergence of stuff that we are as Americans.
Lebanese came here. They had this thing that they could do that was different, but they had to sort of adapt it to Oklahoma palates, and it's been around.
You know, Lebanese are there's a Lebanese diaspora all over the world. I've been spending a lot of time in Brazil lately, and maybe 40, 50 years back, a lot of Lebanese settled on the Brazilian coast, central Brazilian coast, and a lot of Lebanese dishes have entered just the home cooking vernacular.
Hummus, things like that, yeah.
Hummus, kibbeh, but they've been Brazilianized. They're not real Lebanese dishes. They're Lebanese-Brazilian dishes. Like this place that you've just described here. Yeah.
James Uslan is my guest, the editor-in-chief of Sevier Magazine. You can see him as a judge for Bravo's Top Chef Masters, and I think you show up on other shows from time to time, too.
You've kind of become
the celebrity sort of judge of...
Oh, no.
let's talk a little bit about that. What was your first reaction when they asked you to be a judge for, you know, this... you know, reality show of originally Top Chef. Did you start off on Masters? Or did you start out on
done
Top
Chef? I'd done a couple of other programs, Iron Chef America.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And my first reaction was, I swear to you, you've made a mistake. What could you possibly be thinking? And I'm not saying that from some false modesty. It just felt like I honestly felt like it was kind of a joke. Like I Carrie at the prom, something was going to go wrong. And my first season of Top Chef Masters, we shot that first season out in LA. The first couple of episodes that we shot, that was just basically, I guess it's just my essential insecurity. I don't know. But like, that was just echoing over and over in my head. They've made a mistake. What am I doing here? What am I doing? What am I doing? This is like wrong. Then eventually I kind of like gave over and I realized, oh no, I'm whatever. But okay. Maybe
and
I'm assuming
what we see on television is a role.
Well, it is. It is and it isn't. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, how natural is it that you're, you know, basically brought onto a set to eat food in all sorts of crazy conditions and talk about it? How real is that? Except, actually, it is kind of real. After I kind of overcame my initial total terror, it became really fun. And then I just went with it, and I sort of made a pact with myself. Gosh, this is what an amazing job. I get to eat this incredible food in all these crazy places. I'm going to have fun with this. And so that's what I've done ever since.
And the idea of judging these master chefs who, you know, I mean, this is places where you want to usually, you know, you might vie for a reservation. Maybe you wouldn't, but other normal people would.
Oh, I would too.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? And then you're going, okay, well, I think this is a little...
You know, I guess, I don't know, maybe it's a part of like just how I was raised, who I am with my office product salesman dad and living in Yukon, Oklahoma and ending up in Indonesia, et cetera, et cetera. I don't, honestly, I'm not so discriminatory between like, oh, this fantastic chef who was on the cover of the magazines and you have to wait, you know, 10 years to get a reservation at his or her place. Food is food, whether or not it's been cooked by a super fancy highfalutin chef or it's cooked by a very skilled grandmother. Good food is good food.
And by the very nature of the program, it's putting these chefs off their usual – I mean, it's about shaking them up and out of their usual patterns, too.
And hopefully bringing to light their core ability. And I think one of the cool things about the show is really contrary to what a lot of reality shows are about, which is essentially backstabbing and kind of crappy behavior. This show really does sort of celebrate skill and professionalism and doing the best one can do. And I think that's what's so wonderful about watching it. And it's also what's so wonderful about being a participant in it.
Well, the judging, you don't get to see all the things that happen. You just eat the food.
Oh, that's right. And you wish that some viewers knew that, because a lot of times, you know, you get blamed for, you know, that jerk James Osland, he kicked this person off. Doesn't he know? And it's like, no, he doesn't. James just ate a plate of food that maybe wasn't all that, and that's why that person left.
Well, let's talk about Saveur for a moment. This magazine, it seems like a very personal magazine as editor-in-chief. I mean, you're not shy about in either the pages or on the website, mm-hmm. talking about, you know, bringing people into your own little kitchen, which I was surprised to see. Your kitchen has a dish, actually a washing and dryer in the kitchen.
It's New York.
No, and then no dishwasher. You went back to the old dish rack.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never been a great dishwasher fan. It's like my own personal fetish. I'm just not into them.
But the magazine seems very personal.
It is very personal because food is very personal. You know,
you have to have a point of view, really.
You do. I mean, you know, one of the sort of subtle things about Saveur is, yes, we are a food magazine. Yes, we have recipes, some very wonderful recipes. But really at our heart, what we do is we make a magazine that is about people, that's about the human spirit. It's almost just a few notches away from being an anthropology magazine, but instead of like some cold, you know, anthropology magazine, we tell this story of how fabulous and wonderful people are and how connected, how interconnected all of us are in these things that we do in our kitchens and at our dinner tables.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that's why Sevier was able to survive? You know, there's a massive drop of magazines with the Great Recession that just disappeared, you know?
It could be. You know, we're a magazine that elicits for our readers a very emotional reaction. Like, our readers generally don't feel like, oh, this is some magazine. I'm going to clip a few recipes and then I'm going to pass it on to the recycling bin. We're a magazine that tends to, you know, go a little deeper than that. And, you know, when we're at our best, really strike someone in their heart, which is the same kind of thing that really good eating can do. You know, just that great exchange of the human spirit.
I know your last article was Belém on Belém, Brazil. Is that right? Am I saying it right?
You're exactly saying it right. Yeah, it's a city
Is it in the Amazon?
It's in the Amazon. It's at the base of the Amazon River. And it's an old trading city. It goes back probably about four, if not even five centuries. And what an extraordinary place. The food there. You know, see, that's that thing. Here I'm 50 years old, and I thought I knew Brazilian food from my couple of trips there. I went to Belém in the very far north of the country, and I was like, I don't know this food at all. It is completely different than what I've had in, say, São Paulo. Amazing, amazing, complicated, strange, and palate-challenging food, to go back to our thing earlier.
I would bet with the Amazon, I mean, I would think you'd be having some indigenous influences?
Oh, absolutely. They use indigenous ingredients like crazy. And one of their favorite ingredients is this green. It looks totally benign. It looks like spinach. They also use the flower of this green. And what it does is it actually numbs your tongue like Sichuan peppercorn, and which sounds kind of like a scary prospect. But once you get used to it, oh, it's so delicious. And all it just makes you want to eat more and more and more.
Is it hot like a Sichuan peppercorn?
It is a little bit hot. It's a little bit hot. It's a little bit numbing. It's a little bit floral. And it's very, very delicious.
Mm, interesting.
Yeah.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you. I know you right now you're working on something for next summer about the heartland. How far in advance are you working when you're sort of...
We usually work a good 2 years in advance, but this project that we're doing that will appear in the magazine next summer, we're starting a year in advance, and it's a celebration of Prairie Heartland America, Prairie Heartland American cooking, a part of America that does, you know, in all honesty, tend to get overlooked by a large parts of America. So we want to celebrate it.
And I know you just did a barbecue issue not too long ago.
We did last summer.
And that's another thing that we're known for around here. But James Olsland, thanks so very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
James Olsland speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa, the editor-in-chief of Sevier Magazine. His most recent book is as editor of Sevier, the New Comfort Food, which appeared last year, and he is also the editor of the forthcoming The Way We Cook. You can also see him on Bravo Television. He is a judge on Top Chef Masters. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed some of our recent programs over the last couple weeks, they're up on our website. We're a little bit behind, but we're getting caught up. And we hope you'll go to publicradiotulsa.org to catch up with the latest episodes of Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.